Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I don't know what to do for you. Our God is an awesome God. I know that George announced it, Daryl mentioned it, but I've got to say how excited I was to see that total for our Mission Sunday. I was not surprised, but I was a little bit amazed. I know that the elders challenged you, I challenged you, and the way that you responded, well, I love my church. And I love to dream about what God might do with those monies that are going to be put into the mission field. So thank you for that. I want to start with a story that I heard about a preacher who got a little bit frustrated with a particular member who every single Sunday fell asleep in a sermon. And the preacher finally decided, I'm going to do something about it. And so he got up to preach the following Sunday, and sure enough, this guy fell sound asleep. And so the preacher said very softly, everyone who wants to go to heaven, stand up. And of course, everybody stood up except the guy who's asleep. Sit back down. And then he said, everyone who wants to go to hell. And he pounded the lectern and he said, stand up. The guy wakes up, he jumps up, and he looks around, kind of blinking his eyes. And he says, preacher, I don't know what we're voting on, but looks like me and you are the only two that are for it. Now, there's a moral to that story. The moral is this. There's a time to stand up, and there's a time to stand down. And sometimes when you stand up, you might be the only one who's standing up. We are beginning a sermon series this morning. We're going to take a look at some lessons from the life of the Old Testament prophet Elijah. And make no mistake, Elijah was a man who would take a stand. Even if he was the only one who was standing, he took a stand. Elijah's life is an amazing story. But to better appreciate the man, we got to get a little bit of context. We've got to get a little bit of backstory. So this morning, you're going to get just a little bit of introduction to the life of Elijah, but I don't want you to panic, and I don't want you to fall asleep, because it won't be boring. Nothing about the life of Elijah is boring. But to understand the man, we've got to understand the times. And to appreciate the strength of his convictions, we sort of have to understand the weakness of the people. So we're going to take a look this morning and talk just a little bit about the days of Elijah. Elijah lived in the period known as the Divided Kingdom. Remember, there were 12 tribes in Israel. Saul was the first king of Israel, followed by David, followed by Solomon. Because of sin and rebellion in the reign of Solomon, the kingdom was actually divided into what is known as the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. There were 10 tribes that settled in the Northern Kingdom. They're usually referred to as Israel. Their capital was Samaria. There were 2 tribes that were referred to as the Southern Kingdom, usually referred to as Judah in Scripture. Their capital was Jerusalem. The Southern Kingdom, because of sin, because of rebellion, actually was overtaken and carried off by the Babylonians. But 140 years before that, the Northern Kingdom was really all but wiped out by the Assyrians. And the reason why the Northern Kingdom was taken out so much sooner than the Southern Kingdom was because of terrible leadership. In the space of about 200 years, there were 19 kings in the Northern Kingdom, and every single one was evil. In fact, all 19 kings can be wrapped up, kind of summarized with the statement, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. But there was one king who was the most evil of all. I mean, only one can be most, right? So there's one king who is more evil than all the rest, and that distinction belonged to a guy by the name of Ahab. 1 Kings chapter 16, beginning in verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Watch this. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. And you really got to understand what the people before him did to really be able to appreciate that statement. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. I don't know of any married couple that has ever named their son Ahab. And I don't know of any couple that has ever named their daughter Jezebel. In fact, this is the first time that a marriage is mentioned in as far as a king. And the reason why the marriage is mentioned is because Jezebel plays such an important role in this union. Jezebel is pretty much the power behind the throne. In fact, 1 Kings 21:25 says, "There was never a man like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by his wife Jezebel." Jezebel had an agenda, and her agenda was to make Baal worship the national worship of Israel. So let's talk a little bit about Baal. Most scholars will tell you that the correct pronunciation is Baal. You usually hear him referred to as Baal, unless you're from Plant City. It's Baal. I'm just going to call this false god Baal. Baal was the Canaanite god in charge of rain, and that's important, among other things. But mainly, he was supposed to be the god who was in charge of rain, which is an important thing in the Middle East. No rain, no crops. No crops, people die. Jezebel's agenda was to make Baal the official religion of the people, and she did that in a couple ways. First, she supported 850 prophets of Baal. There were 850 prophets of Baal supported by Ahab and Jezebel, which means, of course, she was taxing the people like crazy. Not only did she support 850 prophets of Baal, she supported state execution of any prophets of Jehovah. She was having the prophets of God put to death. Wasn't enough for her just to say, you know, choose Baal, choose Yahweh. She was murdering the prophets of God. And the people of the northern kingdom pretty quickly figured out it's just best to go along in order to get along. It's pretty, you know, safe not to rock the boat, not to take a stand against Ahab or his wife Jezebel, except for one guy by the name of Elijah. Now, I told you just a second ago that the story of Elijah is not going to be boring. And you might be thinking, that's been a little bit boring so far. But let's meet Elijah. Because from the first sentence of the introduction from Elijah, he is taking a stand. So, here we go. 1 Kings chapter 17. Now Elijah, who is from Tishbe in Gilead, told King Ahab, "As surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God whom I worship and serve, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years until I give the word." Notice Elijah just kind of appears out of nowhere, which is kind of interesting because the Jewish people, they love their genealogies. They wanted to know who's his dad, who's his granddad. They wanted to know what tribe is this guy from. We don't know any of that about Elijah. We don't know exactly where Tishbe was. We don't know so many things about this man, Elijah, which I guess goes to prove that you don't have to be a famous person from a famous place to be used by God. So many things we don't know about Elijah, but here's what we do know. We know what his name meant. The name Elijah in Hebrew means My God is Yahweh. So here you have King Ahab, who has built an idol to Baal, put it in the temple of Baal, who is supporting 850 prophets of Baal, who is putting to death the prophets of Yahweh in the name of Baal, and he meets this stranger, and he says, "What's your name?" And the stranger says, "My name is, my God is Yahweh." Right from the beginning, Elijah, his very name speaks his conviction. And Elijah is not appearing before Ahab to negotiate. He comes before Ahab to take a stand. And in this very first encounter with Ahab and Elijah, we're going to see two themes that are going to show up over and over again in this sermon series, sort of central to the ministry of Elijah. And the first one is this: God is alive and well. Elijah's message was a direct insult to Ahab's adopted religion. Look again at what he says. "As surely as Yahweh, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, the God whom I worship and serve," it's not Baal. Israel has a God. It's Yahweh. "He's the one I worship. He's the one I serve." Now remember, Baal is supposed to be the god of rain. And again, rain is really important in the Middle East. Everybody knew then, everybody knows now, that in that part of the world, there is a rainy season followed by a pretty long dry season. So how do you explain the dry season if you worship a god who's in charge of rain? Here's how they did it. Baal died. That was their explanation. Baal died. In fact, Baal died every single year, and it would stop raining. And then Baal would come back to life, and it would start raining again. Elijah shows up and says, "Israel has a God who never dies. Yahweh lives. And you say that your fake God is in charge of rain? See what happens when my God says there will be no rain. Because I'm here to give you a weather report. And it's not going to rain for years. And the reason why God isn't going to send rain is because you have failed to acknowledge His reign." By the way, there is a New Testament reference to Elijah. James, the brother of Jesus, says this: "Elijah was a man just like us. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3.5 years. Elijah was convinced that one man praying to a living God was greater than 850 prophets praying to a dead God. So he stands before Ahab and he says, "You want to battle the gods? My God says, let's go. Because he is alive and well." And here is the second theme of Elijah's message: God alone is to be feared. Almost all of Israel bowed down in fear to Ahab and his wife Jezebel. They ruled through intimidation. Now you think about this. This is and always has been one of Satan's great strategies: to get you to be afraid of something that you shouldn't be afraid of. The NLT translates verse 1 of chapter 17, "As surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God whom I worship and serve." The literal translation there is, "the God before whom I stand." Elijah tells Ahab, "I can stand up to you because I stand before a living God." Ahab wasn't used to people standing up to him. Ahab wasn't used to people challenging him without fear. It's no coincidence that the single most repeated command in Scripture is, don't be afraid. Because Satan knows how debilitating and how paralyzing fear can be. It's one of the main ways that Satan kind of puts pressure on us to cop out and to wimp out and to just go with the flow. It is not just teenagers who deal with peer pressure. And in almost every arena of your life, when you take a stand for God, you're probably going to be standing against the tide of culture. Proverbs 29 says this, "Fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe." And we've all been there, haven't we? We can all think of times in our lives when we had the chance, we had the opportunity to stand up and speak up for God, but we just went with the flow. The fear of man is what keeps people from standing up and saying what somebody needs to say, and standing up and doing what somebody needs to do, and standing up and being who somebody needs to be. The psalmist says in Psalm 56, "When I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust. I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me?" You know what the psalmist is saying? He's saying, you know how to conquer the fear of man? Get a better fear. Get a fear that's a worthy fear. What in the world is a worthy fear? Proverbs 9, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. The knowledge that Elijah had of who God was allowed him to stand up to King Ahab, even when he knew it's not going to be popular. And it could be very dangerous. There are times when taking a stand for God is a dangerous thing to do. John the Baptist, where are you going? Preach. To who? Herod. What's the title of your sermon? Can't have your brother's wife. Have you lost your mind? Because if you preach that sermon, you might lose your head. Stephen, where are you going? Preach. Where? Temple. What's the title of your sermon? God doesn't need the temple anymore and Gentiles can go to heaven. Are you stoned? You preach that sermon, you might get stoned. Elijah, where are you going? Preach. To who? King Ahab. What's the title of your sermon? My God's alive, your God's dead. But Elijah knew. Elijah knew he wasn't there to please any person. He was living for an audience of one. You know, it takes very little courage, really, to stand with the majority. What God is looking for is someone who will take a stand when no one else will. You know, maybe you're going through a dry season in your life right now. Maybe it hadn't rained in a while. Elijah would tell you those trials that you're enduring right now, they're going to cause you to either stand up or shut up. Elijah, James says, was a man just like us. So as we go through this series, don't get distracted by the fire from heaven. Don't get distracted by being fed by ravens. Understand that this is a man that with conviction and constant prayer made a stand for God. And you can too. And sometimes your stand might be the thing that gives someone else the courage to stand. Let me show you a picture of someone that none of you will recognize. Her name is Arlene Limas. She participated in the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, South Korea. She was on the women's taekwondo team. She was a senior at DePaul University at the time. She wasn't really expected to do very much on the world stage, but she stunned everyone, not only medaled, she won a gold medal. And I guess that's probably the greatest dream of any Olympian, maybe any athlete, is to be able to stand on a podium and have someone put a gold medal around your neck, watch, you know, your flag being raised, and hear your national anthem in the entire arena. And so here Arlene Limas stands. The gold medal is placed around her neck. She puts her hand over her heart. The stars and stripes are raised. And there's no music. The arena is completely silent. You could hear a pin drop. The tape machine broke. You know what she did? She started singing. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light. And to start with, she was the only one singing. But her parents were there. They joined in. They started singing. Her teammates were there. They started singing. There were some GIs in the arena. They all started singing. There was American tourists there. They all start singing. Pretty soon, the entire arena is singing the Star Spangled Banner. In fact, she's standing on the podium, sort of directing with her hand. Well, she had to have been from the Church of Christ, right? I mean, to know how to do that. But the entire Colosseum is singing her song. How's God start a revival? One person at a time. One person who is willing to start a song that no one else is singing. The evangelist Gypsy Smith was asked one time, "What can we do to start a revival in our nation?" He replied this way, "You got a house? Yeah. You got a closet in your house? Yeah. You got chalk? Yeah. Go home. Go into your closet and shut the door. Get on your knees. Take a piece of chalk and draw a circle around yourself. And then pray that God will send revival to everyone inside the circle. And don't get up until He's answered that prayer." I want you to think about the things that cause you fear. The things that cause you not to take a stand for God. What area in your life do you find yourself intimidated? Well, maybe it's at school. Maybe it's at work. Everybody knows you at work, but nobody knows that my God is Yahweh. Maybe it's in your marriage. Maybe you need to take a stand for God in your marriage or in your family. In just a minute, we are going to pray a very dangerous prayer together. Revive us again. Fill each heart with Thy love. May each soul be rekindled with fire from above. We're going to pray that the Holy Spirit would be involved in rekindling our soul, to revive us again. So we're going to stand and we're going to sing that song. And I want you to think about what area in your life you need to take a stand. And if there's something going on in your life that you just need the prayers of people who love you, we invite you to meet us down front. Let's go ahead and be standing.